we face destruction. Why, oh why, must this be the
Welcome and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts off with Jack Abramoff. Once the most influential lobbyist in Washington, Jack Abramoff presents an inside look at the lobbying industry and the power it has on Capitol Hill. He discusses his insights with Eliza Newland Carney, staff writer for CQ and Roll Call, covering lobbying and influence. And then, after that, Scott Horton interviews Chris Woods. Chris Woods is a documentary producer and talks about Obama's terror drones, CIA tactics in Pakistan, and the secret war in Pakistan.
This week, former lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his book, Capital Punishment. Since being released from federal custody in 2010, Jack Abramoff has compiled an inside look at the lobbying industry and the power it has on Capitol Hill. He discusses his insights with Eliza Newland Carney, staff writer for CQ and Roll Call, covering lobbying and influence.
The title of your book is Capital Punishment, The Hard Truth About Washington Corruption from America's Most Notorious Lobbyist. A frank title for a frank book. And in this book, you detail events that do not always reflect positively on you, including specifics about the lobbying abuses that led to your felony conviction and imprisonment. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, two things. First, I thought it was important that I present to the country and to the readers what really happens in Washington. I'd gone through quite a journey from the time I was a lobbyist until the time I landed in prison, in terms of rethinking the world I was in and my role in it, and decided that while I was in prison that I should take a different approach to this world, maybe try to do something about it. And part of that would be to talk about it and talk about the kind of things that most people kind of suspect, but they don't really get to know because they don't get to go behind the doors into the rooms that I was in and hear the conversations that I heard as a lobbyist, and be able, by doing that, to enable America to have a true assessment of what their government is, and at least in part, and have become. The second reason I did it was when my case became very public and there were hearings and all sorts of news articles. In fact, there were so many news articles at the beginning, I started collecting them into a folder in my computer, frankly thinking this wouldn't last long, and I might as well save all the articles I'm in. And it became almost a kind of dolorous ritual every morning that I would go and get all the articles from the internet and put them in a folder. And by the time I went to prison, there were over 10,000 different articles about me. And yet, because I didn't speak and I didn't give really a window into my life, I had become kind of an evil cartoon. And I didn't help myself with wearing a hat coming out of my plea in court. And but I had become kind of a villain. And I wanted to show people I'm not an evil person. I'm a regular person. I did things that were wrong, but I don't have a tail or horns. I grew up like everybody else, or maybe not like everybody else, but I have kids, I have a wife, I have a family, and I felt it important to at least tell from my perspective what did happen.
You describe being almost shocked when you first came to Washington, having worked for and headed the College Republicans, when you went to lobby for funding for the MX missile, and a member of Congress says to you, well, I can deliver more than a dozen votes for you if you arrange for me to have a naval base in my district. And you describe feeling very kind of tainted by that. What was it like when you first started out in Washington? What were your initial reactions?
Well, what happened was I was first heading the College Republicans, and during that period of time, we were a political group, political wing of the student wing of the Republican Party. And, you know, we were activists and kind of wacky and wild and did things to instigate trouble and whatnot on the campuses and organize Republicans. When I became head of President Reagan's grassroots lobby, that's when I experienced this moment with Congressman Bustamante, where he said, if you enable us to have this base in my district, I'll organize the votes. And I was shocked by that. I guess you hear about it, you see it on TV, you see it in the movies, but to see it in person at first, for me as a young man, I was very young, in my early 20s, I was very surprised by that, and didn't really encounter a lot of that until I returned to Washington about 10 years later as a lobbyist.
You describe your life as a Washington lobbyist in pretty candid terms, and you describe one of the ways you gained influence is you would extend job offers to congressional aides. And that even before they left those congressional offices, they would have you in mind, and that you felt you effectively had control of that office. Describe how that worked.
Well, at first, when I started building my lobbying practice, I started to look for people to hire. When I joined the lobbying firm, Preston Gates, initially, I was the only person there who had not worked on Capitol Hill. And in fact, during the meetings, initial meetings there, one of the fellows suggested that I go to Capitol Hill and get a job. Well, I wasn't interested in doing that at that point in my life. But everybody else had worked on Capitol Hill. So when the time came to hire other lobbyists, my practice was growing. I needed people to help. I went to Capitol Hill and went among my friends. Now, first, the first couple hires I had came immediately to me. They didn't wait even a week. They gave notice and they joined right away. So I didn't really notice anything. But as I started to hire more and more folks, and I started to look at some of the players on Capitol Hill, mainly the staff, and think, gosh, I really hope I can get her or him to join my practice. When I'd mentioned it, I noticed that at that moment, once they agreed, they would start to have in mind where they were going to go in a year or two, which is, I guess, only natural. People start thinking about their next job. And I noticed that it had an amazing power on them and on their office. All of a sudden, they became, in essence, our agents. And in fact, more than our agents, they thought of things that benefited us and our clients that we couldn't even think of, perhaps as a way of making sure they feathered their nest before they got there.
And in your book, you describe this as one of the biggest problems with the system in Washington.
Right. It's one of the problems in terms of the corruption, and it's also, and it's not to say that everybody who's hired, by the way, is doing this. I'm not trying to, nothing I say is applicable to everybody. But the fact that people can go in the revolving door from public service into cashing in and becoming much more wealthy, frankly, joining lobbying firms or doing whatever they do, is a problem, I think, is a source of corruption. And it's something which I, as a lobbyist, started to use. I knew after a while, after a couple of years of this, that I would strategically plan ahead for the business, and I would try to hire the people who I thought, while they stayed there, they'd be a big help to us while they were there as well. So it's a source of corruption. It's not something people focus on. They're starting to focus on it after I wrote about it, but people don't generally know about this outside of Washington, and it's a very big source of control.
You also describe how you charged clients, including Indian tribes, up to $150,000 a month, even though many other lobbyists were charging about a tenth of that fee. Describe how you came to represent so many Indian tribes, what you did for them, and how these payments came to be held against you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I represented probably at no time did I represent more than a half a dozen tribes at once. Our representations of our clients are very different than most lobbying firms. Most lobbying firms go and ask a client for $10,000-$15,000 a month, and they do some things for them, and they can't engage at those prices in big fights. The people who hired me were in life-threatening fights. They were people who were either about to get put out of business, or they were folks, when I was originally hired by the Choctaw tribe, the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians, it was because the Republican Congress was about to pass a unrelated business income tax that would have taken 30% of the gross revenue of these tribes, and all the lobbyists that they had working on it, which were Democrats at that point, 1995, they couldn't stop this thing. So I was hired and brought in to do that. Initially, I was a law firm, and so law firms charge their clients based on the amount of hours that individual people in the firm spend on the case. And they add up those hours, and they multiply them by the hourly rate that these people use, and that's how they come to their monthly bill. Well, the Choctaw fight got very intense. We won the first go-round, and then there were more rounds and more fights and hearings and this and that, and the bill was getting up there pretty high. And I noticed that the bill was averaging out at about $150,000 a month. And so the other clients who came on had a similar situation. And ultimately, I got to understand that when we went to war unlike what a small, most lobbying firms do, where they do some research and they do a few meetings, we would literally run legislative fights in the entire Congress and hearings, and it was a full-on effort. The time that we would put in, the time that the people who worked for me, and I had upwards of about 40 people working for me at some point, the time they would put in multiplied by the time the law firm charged out, generally wound up to be, on an average basis, around that number. So subsequent clients, when they came to me with their problems, I explained what we would do, I explained the kind of activities we'd be involved in, and I told them this would be the price. And they were threatened to lose hundreds of millions of dollars a year, so I think they felt that a couple million dollars a year in terms, and they were, we usually won.
And yet you have been asked to pay restitution to these clients.
I have indeed. I pled, and the matter of restitution was part of the package there. When I was done lobbying, when my career was over, I sat back and added up the fees that we had collected and the benefits that we had provided, the money we had saved them, the taxes we had stopped from being put on them, the land that we helped them get into their control as tribal reservation land, and try to place some value, conservative value on it. And for about $80 million or so in fees that the firms and I charged, we figured we delivered about $6 billion in value. So in that, to me, was the measure of my representation of my clients. And by the way, the reason my clients continued to hire me year after year, I didn't have contracts like most lobbying firms do. Most lobbying firms have a contract saying you've got to hire us for a year or 2 years, and no matter what, you can't break that contract. My deal with my clients was, if you don't like me, fire me that afternoon, and you don't owe me a thing going forward. In fact, I had one client, which was a foreign country, who wanted us to represent them. They wanted to give some a port to the U.S. to create a naval base, and we were lobbying to get the U.S. to take that place and maybe set up a U.S. naval base there. It would have been very strategic in the country of Eritrea. And unfortunately, Eritrea was in the practice at that point, once we started representing, they started arresting members of the staff of the U.S. Embassy who were Eritreans, but they were arresting them and holding them without charges. And the State Department, obviously, was very upset about this. So I went to them and said, listen, you got to charge them or let them go. You know, and in this country, we don't do that. And they said, well, in our country, we do that. So I said, I can't represent you any longer because I can't do anything for you. And I offered to give them back all their money because I hadn't achieved what we had achieved. They said that they couldn't do it because they made those as government payments. But that was my attitude toward my clients. If I didn't deliver value for them, I didn't want to be paid by them.
Describe handing a senator an envelope of contributions and being told the Indian Affairs Committee would treat your clients well. And you say in the book that while campaign money is a problem, it's not the only problem or even the main problem. What is the main problem in your view?
Well, campaign money is certainly part of the main problem. The main problem, there are four main problems that identify in terms of solutions in the book to some of the corruption. The overall problem, by the way, is the federal government's too big. The federal government's in too many things. There are 30,000 or whatever the number is lobbyists running around, because there need to be 30,000 lobbyists running around. The government's involved in hundreds of thousands of things that far exceed any vision of this country from the past. So that's the reason that this industry is growing continually. There's never a bad year in the lobbying industry, as there's never a bad year, by the way, around this town. But what I feel is, if you're not going to be able to reduce the size of government immediately, then the money that gets involved, the campaign contributions on the one hand, and then also the gratuities and meals and trips and tickets to ball games and everything else, however one gets them through, the loopholes that are left in the law, any of these things ultimately, unfortunately, come down to being bribes. I know it's not polite to say that. I certainly didn't think it when I was in there, but I'm not quite sure how else one looks at it. If you're giving a public servant something of value and you want that public servant to do something for you, I don't know how you characterize it as anything else at this point in my life. That's number one. Number two, the revolving door between public service and cashing in. And whether one's cashing in as a lobbyist or a strategic advisor or a history professor or whatever the euphemism of the day is, it's still cashing in. And I think America looks at this and sees folks show up in this town worth $20,000 and leaving at worth $20 million. And they're scratching jobs. We don't have any food on the table. Meanwhile, these guys are getting rich. So I think that's another thing. The other two that I think can go after the corruption, one is term limits. I have to tell you, as a lobbyist, I was against term limits. And I used to pretend, or at least convince myself, that I was against term limits because you want to have people have the right to vote for whomever they want. And there's a value to having people in town a long time. Well, both of those are not true. The truth is, a lobbyist don't want term limits because the lobbyists don't want to go buy a congressman's office twice. If you have a congressman that you made a relationship with through these unfortunate methods, you don't have to start all over after a new election. And so I think term limits are important in terms of getting new blood through this town. And then finally, the other thing I talk about in the book is a proscription, one of the main pillar proscriptions, is trying to get these guys to apply every law they make to themselves. Recently, we've seen this insider trading scandal, but we know there are other laws that they're also not applied to these folks, and they should be applied. It's not right. How do you send a guy like Rajaratnam to prison for 11 years for insider trading? At the same time, a member, if he were a member of Congress, he wouldn't have to go anywhere. I think that's not fair. It's not right. And so the laws they make need to be applied to themselves.
When you speak about the campaign contributions, and you use the term bribery, mm-hmm. also in the book, and I wanted to quote briefly, you say, you describe at one point a particular senator you were told would support you if he received a $5,000 check for the campaign. And as you describe it, of course, neither of us considered for a moment that this contribution was in fact merely a bribe. So are you saying that campaign contributions are bribes? And is this type of exchange common on Capitol Hill?
Well, it's very common. It's common all over town, all over Washington. I don't think it's a bribe if you're a citizen and you care about your government and you want to give money in whatever amount to somebody who's running for Congress or the Senate or the presidency, and you're doing it for the betterment of the country, you're doing it for sort of macro issues. But if you're doing it because you want to get an earmark, or you're doing it because you want to get a tax break, or you're doing it because you want to get a grant or a contract or things like that, I don't see how that's not a bribe.
You describe the restaurant that you started, Signatures, becoming a virtual cafeteria and fundraising hub for groups of members of Congress and their staff. You describe that you showered the staff with gifts and with meals and tickets to sporting events. I think you said you spent $1.5 million a year on sporting event tickets. And you also describe the notorious Scotland trip where mm-hmm. you played on the old course at St. Andrews. Under the lobbying and ethics reforms passed after you were convicted, all of that would now be illegal. Do you believe the lobbying and ethics reforms put in place after you left Washington have improved the system?
I think they've marginally improved it, but I don't think they've solved it. There's still many, many loopholes. I'll give you an example. I can't take a member to lunch and buy them a hamburger for $25 or whatever the price of hamburgers are in this town. But if I declare that lunch a fundraising lunch and I pull out of my pocket $5,000 checks and I say, you know, we're having a fundraising lunch, here's the checks, I can buy them a hamburger, and I can then have the same conversation. That's a loophole. That's a way around it. And so there are many loopholes still, and I think what we see is we see reform go through where they take away certain things, but ultimately they're not making systemic changes, which is what has got to happen. There's got to be a shutting of the door. No conveyance of anything of value between people lobbying or people importuning the government and trying to get benefits for themselves or their companies or their communities or whatever they're doing. No financial conveyance to a public servant at all. Not a dollar, not a pickle, not a glass of water, nothing.
At the time you were under scrutiny on Capitol Hill, you were quoted as saying that you were being pilloried for activities that were commonplace in the lobbying world. Do you still believe that's true?
Well, unfortunately, I think that what I was pilloried for, 90% of it was legal. 10% of it, I went over the line maybe 10% or less of the time. Now, I went to prison for those things, but most of what I did was legal. And most of what everybody else is doing here is legal. I don't accuse others of breaking the law. I guess I'm accusing the entire system of being over the line. Not the legal line, but the appropriate line. And so in that respect, yes, people certainly are doing what I did. I didn't invent anything. I didn't create the idea of taking people golfing or to meals or to sporting events or any of that. I just overdid it. I had my own restaurant. I had my own plane. I overdid it, and I crossed the lines.
And what about the lobbying industry today? What is your opinion of it? And what works or doesn't work about the way lobbying is conducted now in Washington?
Well, I think that it's important to note that there are many, many good most lobbyists are fine. Probably not doing anything wrong or illegal nor untoward in any way. I don't have numbers and percentages, but my experience was that most of the lobbyists play on a sort of much more quiet scale than I did, and that some of the bigger folks do. That doesn't mean that the kind of things I did are not going on today. They are. And there was a lobbyist who was indicted and sent to prison after me, after my scandal, and continued doing it. So people don't really learn when they see somebody like me go down. It's more like, and I try to liken it to, you're driving on the road, and all of a sudden you see a terrible car wreck, and their body's strewn all over the place. And as you drive by, you slow down, and you look at that, and you're scared for a little bit. And the next mile, you're perfect. You're not breaking any laws. You're just unbelievable. 5 miles down the road, you've forgotten it already, and you're back to speeding. And I think that that's sort of what goes on here.
One of the things you talk about in the book is your life as an Orthodox Jew and the Jewish charities you gave money to. And a question arises, given your commitment to Jewish morals, you know, how did you land at the center of one of this decade's most celebrated ethics controversies?
You know, it's interesting. When I was a lobbyist, I actually didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I thought I was doing what everybody does. Maybe I was aggressive and pushing the envelope, and that was my personality. I was a hyper-aggressive person my whole life. But I didn't really quite see where I was in this forest for these trees. That's my own fault. I think I liken it to sometimes when you set off on a voyage on a ship and you have a sextant, and if your sextant is one small degree off base, you're not going to notice that at the beginning. You may not even notice in the middle of your trip, but by the time you're done your trip, you're on a place you never even dreamed you'd wind up, and that's sort of what happened with me. Unfortunately, I lost sight of what I believed and what I knew. A lot of it had to do with the competition of my wanting to win. I had too much of a desire to never lose for my clients. I loved the competition. I played rough. Our guys played rough. If you attacked one of my clients and you were from Capitol Hill, you would expect us to come after you in your election. We were a very thuggish group of lobbyists, I'm sorry to say, that kind of aggression and that kind of activity, unfortunately, was made normal to me by the fact that I thought I was protecting clients whom I loved and who I basically supported all their issues. I made a lot of money for them and for me. My wife and I gave away 80% of the money we made to charity and community causes. So it's not like I was, unfortunately, for my current situation, it's not like I invested it wisely. Although I guess one could say that helping people is not a bad investment. So while doing all that, I thought I was doing good stuff. I looked at other lobbyists and thought, you take $10,000 a month from this poor client, you lead them down the primrose path, they get defeated, they get in trouble, they don't win, and you don't care. Your attitude is, well, I'll just get another client. With us, our attitude was, we are going to live or die with our client. If our client loses, we don't come back alive. That literally was the ethos, for better or for worse, in our office. And so looking at all that while I'm in the middle of that forest, I thought I was the moral lobbyist. This is the irony of my life. I not only didn't think I was immoral, I thought I was moral. Unfortunately, I had gone so far off the path that was my perception.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. Feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you. Of tender years, can't know the fears that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
And now for something completely different.